The pride, passion, and pageantry of college football lives here. This is the Paul Feinbaum Show, Hour 3 Podcast.
The second half program is live, and we are back. It's been a busy one with Joe Tess talking about the Alabama spring game. Todd McShay coming up here in a few minutes. We'll preview the baseball weekend later in the show with Kyle Peterson. We've already talked about the Georgia game and the LSU game. Now we talk about the Auburn game under first-year coach Brian Harsin. Matt Stinchcomb joining us. Matt, thank you. Great to have you back on the program. And when you have a new coach, fans want to see something. So what are we to expect tomorrow?
Well, there's definitely, you know, excitement. Maybe among the fan base, a little trepidation, given that a new face and a face that's coming from a different part of the world, from the college football landscape, albeit a really accomplished one in Brian Harsin. And in fact, really the coaching staff with some familiar names on it, and offensive coordinator Mike Bobo, Derek Mason, former head coach there at Vanderbilt, coordinating the defense. I think all of that could give you kind of a soft landing spot if you're a fan to say, look, there is some familiarity on this coaching staff. And, you know, football is still just football, albeit perhaps with a heightened emphasis in the state of Alabama and given who they share the state with. But I will say that, you know, the eyeballs from the head coach and from that coaching staff, they're going to be in the same places, I think, that most of the fan base is aware of from areas of concern. I mean, you think about from a pass protection standpoint, they want to try to keep not just Bo Nix, but the passers clean in general. And last year, that was a major deficiency and contributed, I think, to some of what could be perceived as regression with Bo Nix and his performance, turnovers plaguing the offense. But a lot of that was a function of an inability to function in the passing game from a clean pocket. And can they provide that? And I'm not sure that they've got it quite figured out. They might have the guys on campus that they need. They might not have identified the ideal spots for them as far as along the offensive front. And out wide, the wide receiver position, where are those yards and catches going to be generated given what's been lost? You know, the thing of it is, I think more than anything else, you're coming off a COVID season with a new coaching staff, significantly new faces on the defensive side of the football, and you've got coaches that are not only learning each other, but learning their roster and guys that they have to work with. I'll be surprised if they don't have, masking tape with the players' names on their helmets still, because, you know, these coaches probably haven't had a lot of time to stop and actually get to know these kids. They've had to hit the ground running and figure out where they fit best to give them the best position of success. So the fans are going to want to see probably the laser light show like everybody else, especially offensively. I don't know that they get it, and I don't know that that's even the most important thing. More than anything else, I think what they're looking for is to see, as they've assembled these players, especially with the pieces that have to work together, how well do they look, how good do they look at this juncture, and can they build off of that when they get into summer camp?
Matt, certainly you're very familiar with Mike Bobo, but I know that you can't just make a lot of assumptions here, but knowing Bobo and knowing his track record and trying to marry that to what you've already seen these past 2 years of Bo Nix, how does it work?
Yeah, well, I tell you, he's got a great track record when it comes to quarterbacks. You look back to his years at Georgia and the productivity that he's got, not just offensively, but out of that position specifically. And that coaching staff and Mike, you know, specifically, that he's high on the skill set that Bo Nix has. And I think you could point to, from an athleticism standpoint, the run element, the ability to extend plays. I think it's inarguable that perhaps a propensity to try to do more than he should to extend plays when otherwise he should just let it die. Those are things that you can get coached out of. That's something that can change. But it does seem as if there's a good bit of enthusiasm around the quarterback position. And, you know, Coach Harsin, offensive-minded guy that's got some ideas, to say the least, and a great deal of success on that ball side of the ball. It's not as if it will be just a top-down, siloed approach from Coach Bobo's perspective as far as what's going to happen at that position. There's a great deal of input, and I think integration offensively from what will be coming from Harsin's time at Boise State, but from a skill set standpoint and the coachability, the awareness, all the things, the kind of soft science stuff that we hear about players, they seem to be really pleased and bullish about what they have with Bo Nix. All of that comes with the disclaimer of, but you got to play well around him. You know, he's a guy that can help you win games. I don't think he's a guy that can carry a team. And he's going to need the guys around him to step up and play better. And that, you know, at the running back position, primarily, is an area that I think can really start to take on more of the load this year. Tank Bigsby's got to play better. He played well last year. He's got to be consistent and healthy. Sean Shivers is going to have to contribute more. But those pieces, I think, can complement a quarterback position I think they like from a skill set standpoint in Bo Nix.
With Matt Stinchcomb, the SEC Network analyst, on the Auburn game tomorrow, finally, what will Derek Mason bring to the table?
You know, when you look back when he was actually coordinating the defense, even in his time at Vanderbilt, and some of the players that came out of that program, and you think about, so, you know, the guys like Zach Cunningham, and to his days at Stanford, the guy knows ball, and he coaches it back to front, you know, from a secondary standpoint, towards the line of scrimmage. It's not dissimilar from many coordinators, especially in this conference now, being more secondary-minded first. But I do think that based on the types of performances the Auburn defenses have been able to put together under Kevin Steele, and despite Gus Malzahn being an offensive-minded coach, you know, the highlight of those teams has been the ability of that defensive unit to really lead the way, and it has for the past several seasons. I don't know that they take a step backwards. I do think the deployment will look different, to say the least, but they've got the skill set to work with and around. They've got some size up front. They do have to do better and improve on the edges. Owen Papo at linebacker is an every-down player, who should be one of the elite defensive players in the country. And I think Derek Mason does a really good job of amplifying the skill set and the skills of the players that he has available to him. And gosh knows he had to learn how to do that, certainly at Stanford and even more so at Vanderbilt, given some of the raw materials that he has now at Auburn. I'm really anxious to see what a Derek Mason-led defense can look like in the Southeastern Conference with the talent level, like a program that Auburn can bring to the field.
Matt Stinchcomb, SEC Network, on the call tomorrow, Auburn's A-Day game. That is 2 o'clock Eastern time. And we have so much more to do. We have Todd McShay coming up in just a moment on the draft. Nobody knows this stuff better than he does. Later on, Kyle Peterson previewing the biggest baseball weekend of the year. We've already talked to Joe Tess on the Alabama scrimmage and LSU and Georgia scrimmage. I mean, it's just endless today, the amount of conversation that we are having. And Woody Page in the 6 o'clock hour. We will take a short break.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
You're not worth a flip.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-hour energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5hourenergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5hourenergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%. Is your schedule too packed to see a doctor about your erectile dysfunction? Well, with Hims, now you can get treated for ED without stepping foot outside your door. They're changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. Hims provides access to doctor-trusted ED treatment options such as chewable hard mints, brand-name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and entirely online. Just answer a series of questions and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option. If prescribed, your medication ships to you free. No insurance needed. So what are you waiting for? Join the hundreds of thousands of trusted Hims subscribers and get treated. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/paul. That's hims.com/paul for your personalized ED treatment options. hims.com/paul. Hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies on product and subscription plan.
And we are back, and it's so great to have Todd McShay on with us, the ESPN draft analyst, just 2 weeks before the draft, 2 weeks from last night. Todd, thanks so much for making time. You roam the sidelines. You don't troll them during the college football season.
I probably do both.
You should do that. But it's great to have you to talk about the draft. And we had Mac Jones on this time yesterday, and I know it's almost become cliche to talk about him, but you know, he does seem to be the generator of so much conversation, and we haven't had a chance to hear yours. So where are you on Mac?
I've actually really loved the journey that he's been through, you know, and you don't see many guys, especially with the portal and college football and all these quarterbacks kind of moving on from one place to the next if they're not going to start. And the fact that he stuck around Alabama, even though Tua Tagovailoa was there, and then like when he finally got his chance, throwing two pick sixes against Auburn, and then bouncing back and basically putting them in position to potentially kick a field goal late in that game to tie it up and go to overtime. And then he plays so well in the bowl game against Michigan. And then this year, sitting down with Steve Sarkisian, the former offensive coordinator at Alabama, and talking to him, I'll never forget. He said, listen, what we need from Mac is for him to just stay in his lane. We've got three offensive linemen who are going to get drafted. We've got two wide receivers that are first-round picks in Jalen Waddle and Devontae Smith. And then we've got a running back in Najee Harris who's going to be probably a first-round pick as well. Then 4 or 5 games later, we had the second game and we were prepping, and he said, you know what, I'm starting to give him more and more information. And then the last game we had late in the season with myself and Sean McDonough and Todd Blackledge, Sarkisian turned to us and said, you know what? I have never given more in terms of installing an offense to a college quarterback than I have to Mac Jones. That's how quickly he's picked everything up. So you combine that with what you see on tape with the pocket presence and the accuracy and the toughness that he brings. And even like the analytics match up with everything you see on tape as well. Like the three most important things that I look for in a quarterback are the QBR when pressured, when blitzed, and 21-plus yards throwing down the field, trying to translate them to the National Football League. And he's number one among all these guys, ahead of Trevor Lawrence, ahead of Zach Wilson from BYU, ahead of Justin Fields and Trey Lance. So he brings so much to the table. The thing that's interesting about him is he doesn't have the mobility. You know, Trevor's got it. Zach Wilson's got it. Fields ran a 4.44 in his 40. And Trey Lance from North Dakota State is mobile and a tough runner as well. But he wins with his mind. And I'm fascinated to see if San Francisco sitting at 3 after moving up from 12. They clearly knew the quarterback that they wanted to go get. Is Kyle Shanahan, is he thinking, hey, look, I want to get a guy that knows the offense and can think the way I think? Or am I going to go get a mobile quarterback? And if that's what he wants, then it's going to be Lance or Fields and not Mac Jones.
Talking to Todd McShay, and after that, Todd, the well-plowed conversation about the number four position with Atlanta. I mean, there's so many great choices. You have three wide receivers from the SEC that I don't know how you differentiate. And then you have Kyle Pitts, who can do yep. pretty much everything. I know you don't close your eyes, but how did you come up with dividing those four players?
It's tough because, first of all, we know three quarterbacks are going 1, 2, 3. Whatever, you know, we know Trevor Lawrence, I'm almost certain that it's going to be Zach Wilson, number two to the Jets. And then if it's Mac Jones or one of the other two quarterbacks, then that will be the first three. And Atlanta, they've got a tough decision to make because you've got Matt Ryan for at least 1 year, probably two more years. And he's been durable, and he's still productive. You've got Julio Jones and Calvin Ridley. I would love to, you know, if you're going to try to make a run at this thing and turn things around from being the fourth pick to being a playoff team, I'd love to bring in Kyle Pitts. Pitts has the highest tight end grade that I've ever given to a tight end in 20 years, Paul, of doing this. 20 years. Think about that. I mean, his wingspan is the longest of any tight end that's ever been measured. And he's athletic. He can get off the press. He gives effort as a blocker. He's not great. I'm not saying he's an inline blocker, but he'll give effort as a move blocker. And he can separate, and then he makes contested catches down the field. And he also runs after the catch. So, I mean, I think he's special. If I was Atlanta, I would think long and hard about passing on Pitts, even though I'm assuming we're not going to pick this high again, and we may not be staring at a quarterback that could be our guy for the next, you know, 8-10 years. But I just think if you've got Matt Ryan, why not give him a chance and put more weapons around him, and hopefully you stay healthy and you can utilize, you know, what you have in terms of weapons on the offensive side.
And what is the dividing line between Ja'Marr Chase, Devontae Smith, and obviously Waddle?
It's a good question. So I've struggled with all three. And at the end of the season, before I went back and studied more tape, I had Devontae Smith as the number one wide receiver. Because, I mean, he was coming off, and you saw it. You saw every snap, I'm sure. He had the best season of a wide receiver in the history of college football. Won the Heisman Trophy. He stepped up when Jalen Waddle went down. And Smith, I mean, he loves the game. I love being on the sideline around him. I think I've been around for six games the last 2 years, just watching those four receivers 2 years ago and the three receivers this past year, the way they chirp at each other, they compete, they yell at each other, talking to Sark about how he comes off the field. It's like having another quarterback, you know, at the wide receiver position, telling him about the defensive coverages and all these different things. But then I went back to 2019 and watched the tape of Joe Burrow throwing the ball to Ja'Marr Chase. And they had Justin Jefferson, who went on to have, I think, 88 catches for the Minnesota Vikings this past year, and other great weapons. The only, you know, to me, like, it's tough because Ja'Marr Chase physically is the most gifted of the three. Devontae is the most NFL-ready of the three. He's Marvin Harrison. Like, that's who he is. Lean, skinny legs, doesn't have the number one wide receiver build. But the dude is just so competitive, so smart, so good, and like just silky smooth as a route runner. And then there's Jalen Waddle, who in the first four games when he was healthy, as great as Devontae is, he had 13 fewer catches but 74 more yards. I mean, think about that. How do you have 74 more yards with 13 fewer catches? It just shows you the explosiveness. So I think all three of those guys, Chase, Smith, and Waddle, are all going to come off the board. If not in the top 10, there's no chance that any of those three get past number 12 for Philadelphia.
Todd, finally, asking what the biggest surprise of the first round is like, you know, asking you for a stock tick tip. But because we always see something utterly bizarre happen, and I'm not asking you to predict it because you would already, that's not what you're doing, but how do those things happen? How does every year you sit there on set this year on ABC, just look at your fellow seatmates and just shake your head? What was the guy thinking?
Yeah, I mean, we've talked a lot about the five quarterbacks that are going to go in the first round: Trevor Lawrence, Zach Wilson, Mac Jones, Trey Lance, Justin Fields. I don't think for a second that there's going to be a sixth quarterback in the first round, but it's happened before where someone sneaks in, you know, the 31st, 32nd pick, a team moves up and says, you know what, I want to get ahead of these other teams and make sure we get our guy. And also, you got to remember, when you pick in the first round, you have that fifth-year option, and so teams value that, especially at the quarterback position. Davis Mills from Stanford is, in my opinion, the guy that's kind of moving up. He only started 11 games at Stanford, but he was the number one quarterback recruit coming out in his class. He had some injuries, but he's supremely talented. Kellen Mond is the next guy. Kyle Trask both guys obviously from A&M, Florida, respectively, from the SEC. So it'll be interesting to see where those quarterbacks go. We know that Denver could pick a quarterback at 9, but if they don't, they pick at 40. And you've got Washington at 51 and Chicago at 52. Both need a quarterback and probably are not going to get one of the first-round guys. So I'm not saying it's going to be in the first round, but I'm interested to see where that sixth quarterback goes. Which quarterback is it? Is it Mills or Mond or Trask? And then which team is kind of moving up to make sure that they get the guy they really want?
Finally, one more question about an Alabama player, of course, Najee Harris, who, I mean, we all know how great he was this year, but is it more him or is it just that position right now in the draft just doesn't get the respect it did really a couple of years ago and throughout the history?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I have him as the number one running back in the class. I've put him in every mock draft in the first round, I think to either Pittsburgh or the Jets, one of those two teams. And I think the biggest difference that I saw from him this past year, and he said on Adam Schefter's podcast that I could kiss his caboose, if you will.
Yeah, I saw that.
He was not happy with me, which I still can't understand, but I love the competitiveness. But I if you have him as the number one running back and you have him in the first round and you're talking about improvement, I really don't see where the issue is, but it's all good. I've heard a lot more criticism from players before. But the two differences were this past year. I remember studying him in July and watching the tape and thinking, you know what, he's 235 pounds, but he dances a little too much. I'd love to see him just be more physical and aggressive north and south. And then the other thing was he wasn't a huge part of the passing game. And I watched, he doesn't think I did, but I watched every snap from his sophomore year, junior year, and then now the senior year. And Steve Sarkisian just got him more involved, catching the ball. And he showed that he can adjust. You know, if the ball's thrown out outside of his frame, he can go get it, and he's a threat after the catch. So the aggressiveness as a runner and then the passing game is what, in my opinion, that's why he came back to school. Same thing with Travis Etienne from Clemson. They both came back to school, which is rare for a senior running back to come back to school when you can be a second-round draft pick. But they both came back, and I think they earned their spot late in the first round, and I give Najee a lot of credit for what he did and the adjustment and how much he improved.
Todd McShay, it's so great to have you on, Todd. I know your schedule is breakneck right now, so we appreciate it. We hope to see you soon.
You got it, my man. Take care.
Thank you very much. Todd McShay, what a fantastic analysis that was. We still have another 90 minutes to go. I don't remember a Friday afternoon out of season being this jam-packed, but we'll cover it all in the final 90 minutes, and we hope you will stick around.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
You're not worth a flip.
Tired of ads interrupting your favorite sports podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music, included with your Prime membership. Amazon Music offers the most ad-free top podcasts. Enjoy shows like First Take, Pardon the Interruption, and The Low Post, available ad-free and uninterrupted. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or go to amazon.com/ESPNpods. That's amazon.com/ESPNpods to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I realize it's been literally forever since we've been to the calls, and I apologize, but there is, you know, some of these days you just have, it's like, Hartsfield on a Friday afternoon with the planes just getting stacked up. That's how we've been with guests. But we will get back to the calls now at 855-242-7285, and Jerry is up next. Hello, Jerry. Good afternoon.
Hello. I would like to know what your thoughts are on Nick Saban humiliating that reporter yesterday and what you thought about that.
Well,
and I'd like to talk to you some more.
Yeah, that's done. Okay. I mean, I am never wild about that. Having been a young reporter asking those questions, I've never felt Saban needed to do it. I understand what he was trying to say. He was trying to say, you really don't know the backstory on the formulation of that question. but I also don't think it's really necessary.
All right. Do you think that he thought he might be asked the question about the most important position on the field with a newcomer coming in? And the guy assumed that the guy that's going out there with the first team is the first team guy?
Yeah.
I don't think that's too much of a stretch.
Yeah, Jared, you know, my theory on it is a little bit different, but I'm not disagreeing here. I think he was afraid that someone was going to ask a more pertinent question. And I think tomorrow afternoon it will become obvious what he was trying to avoid, if you follow me. Because there's been
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. So my theory is that he felt that question coming, so he subterfuged. And he knew
he had this planned all along.
Right. He loved. Yeah. And I have no doubt he does. I've been to enough Nick Saban press conferences over the years where he walks in and you can sometimes tell, and he doesn't even need the question. And you're right. I mean, I've seen him humiliate people a lot worse than that. And I have confronted him on live television before, and it's quite a feeling to try to get something out of him, as the whole SEC media days could tell from about 5 years ago. But I think I think he was more than anything trying to avoid having to answer a specific question.
Well, what he does is berates these guys to the point where any crumb he feeds them, they're like dogs wagging their tail.
Well, Jerry,
he got a phone call from somebody apologizing for him, but they're, now what will happen is Bryce Brown has a bad start to the year. Nobody's going to have the guts to say, hey, are you thinking about benching him? He's controlling all that months in advance.
And well, you may be right, but Nick Saban has done this since the first day he's been there. He met with reporters in mass groups in 2007, and he said, I will answer anything that you ask me, but if you violate, and he laid out certain particulars, he said, you're done. And he laid down the law pretty early, and I will say not many people have challenged him over the years.
They're scared to death of him.
Well, let me ask you a question. I say this as someone who has confronted him before, but if you're a young reporter and you need the job in a very depressed industry, and you cross him and you're dependent on subscribers, viewers, or listeners, and he suddenly ostracizes you, you're probably going to be unemployed. I mean, we're not talking about Watergate here. We're talking about a very one-sided relationship.
Yep, you're right. And this is the way the Watergate question doesn't get asked. Like, how many people have asked him about Rush Probst's accusations? Anybody?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Exactly. Now, do you think that's a story worth maybe asking a question or two about if you're a quote-unquote media person, if you're a journalist or...
Yeah. Now I'll tell you how I would do it, Jerry. I would not do it at a public press conference. I would do it in his office, because I think sometimes, you know, if you can get in there. Now that's there. I'm not saying everybody can get in there either. But I would, if I had some reason to follow that allegation up, I would make an appointment and ask him in private.
Well, I can tell you right now, the people that get the interviews aren't the ones that are going to ask questions
well,
like that.
Well, Jerry, let me assure you, I hear you very loud and clear, and I have been the only reporter at an Alabama press conference asking a tough question, and I have found myself ostracized and singled out. I'm not talking about under Saban. I'm going way beyond Saban. I know how it feels, and I'm still around, but I did it a different way, and I would do it differently today. So I think you just have to pick your spots as a reporter. If you have something significant with Nick Saban, I would not ask it at a public press conference. I would go see him.
Well, I'm on the lookout for the next young Paul Feinbaum.
Well,
let me know if you hear where he's writing.
Jerry, thank you. Let me know if you find one, because I'll be happy to move over. This is not. And what Nick Saban did, I didn't think was that outrageous. I have said before, very, very, very public about his treatment of reporters. When I think he's been unfair, I've said it. And most of the time, Saban has apologized. I got that call from him one day, and it's quite interesting to hear Nick Saban be conciliatory. But in the case yesterday, I don't think that was about the reporter. I think that was about Saban trying to control the environment. And that's what smart people do. If you're a politician or a football coach or anyone for that matter, you try to control the playing field as best you can. If you're concerned that a question is going to be asked that you really don't want to answer, and I'm willing to bet you that Nick Saban went in there hoping he didn't get asked a specific question. And by the way, what I'm talking about is nothing about him. It's just about his football team right now. We'll take a break. More to come. More of your questions right here.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
You're not worth a flip.
And we are back. Great to have you with us here on a Friday afternoon. And Donnie is in Arkansas. Hey, Donnie.
Hey, woo pig, Paul, woo pig.
You got
it. I just want to say I'm so happy Musk got his contract. He's staying with us. I love it. I love it. I love it. And I got a question for you. So if you want to bring up the Razorback football schedule while I say these two other things, you can go and bring that up. But basketball, man, and baseball is great. We got two girls drafted in the top 15 off the women's basketball team. So I think Razorback sports are moving up in the world. I know a guy called earlier about respect and all that stuff. I said, we got to win to get respect, and that's what's got to happen. And I know that. I feel what he's saying, but I'm just saying I know what that's about. So I want to ask you about the spring game, the Hogs. Are you going to flip over there and watch a little bit of it?
First you better question. Believe it, of course.
The second question is, how do you feel like they're going to do this year? I want to go through the schedule. Now, we got 20 of 22 starters returning. And
yeah,
with our new recruits that came in.
Let me read the schedule for those not watching, because we have it up. Rice, Texas, Georgia Southern, Texas A&M, at Georgia, at Ole Miss, Auburn, Pine Bluff, Mississippi State, LSU, Alabama, Missouri. I'm trying to do the math in my head. 1, 2, 3, 4. Man, I tell you what, I'm struggling to get to a lot of wins. What about you?
We owned Mississippi last year, so that's two.
Don't be so sure you're going to Ole Miss this year.
Why can't we do it again?
Well, you can't. I would say you'll beat State at home. You might beat Auburn at home, Pine Bluff, Missouri. Can you beat Missouri at home?
Possibly. I mean, it's going to depend on how the schedule goes.
I'm looking. Let me do it one more time. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
So you're saying we can't beat Texas?
I think you can. I think a bowl game is in the cards. I'll go that far. How about that?
Okay. I'll take that.
Okay. It won't be easy, I think getting to a bowl game, I think, is very realistic, and could be even better. I mean, if the Razorbacks beat Texas,
Paul, I'm saying right here, Arkansas is going to have the number one defense in the SEC. I'm saying it right here on your show.
Okay.
Can we mark it down? I already wrote it down. I'm going to call you back after the season's over, and then you can tell me that I was so wrong or I was right. Either one.
Well, I hope you're right. I hope you're right about that. Hey, John is up next in Atlanta. Hello, John.
Hey, buddy. Back in the day, you and I used to do some Bama Bowl bashes. I know you remember some of those events.
Oh, I do. Those were fantastic.
Around the bowl game. Yeah, we the playoffs kind of messed the rhythm up. It's kind of hard to plan when you got 1 week.
No, I remember we did one in New Orleans and in Miami.
Yeah, we had 10,000 people at that party in
New
Orleans.
That New Orleans thing was insane. I mean, it was absolutely, I had a hard time getting in and out of there.
you know, we underestimated the Alabama fan. But, you know, so I'm in the live event space through live concerts, tours, festivals, and obviously I've not done a whole lot of that over the last year. Literally last night, after a 398-day streak of no concerts indoors, we broke that streak in Pittsburgh last night with a sold-out show, and so we're finally getting things going again.
That is so great to hear.
Yeah, we were. I was on a panel last year with several promoters from all over the country, and I kept telling them, I said, you know, if college football does not have fans in the stadiums, there's just absolutely no way we're going to see fans in the arenas. And obviously the very limited crowds last year, and obviously no arena tours. And I want to tell you something. Whenever Nick Saban came out publicly a month ago, whatever it was, and basically was one of the first people, if not the first, to say our stadium will be full of fans in the fall, there was a shift that happened in the concert industry, and you started to see tours like the Eric Church Tour and so many others. But, you know, just as a Bama fan and a live event, you know, promoter, it was just funny and kind of a little bit rewarding to see how powerful Nick Saban's voice is, where he says, we're going to have a crowd, and how that really just made a shift in the live industry of events and what we're planning to do, you know, this year.
That is, I'm so glad to hear that, John, because we've talked to some of the artists over the fall and into the winter, and you know them a lot better than I do, but some of those guys, we're talking about big country stars. I mean, they were going crazy.
Oh, man. Well, you know, we do a big country festival in Coleman called Rock the South.
Sure.
And this is our 10th year, and we literally just had the biggest on sale in the history of the festival, so we're really believing people are wanting to get back out, fully anticipating being able to do that.
So, I don't want to run out of time here, John, because I want to continue this maybe a later day. But when, I mean, I know what you said about Pittsburgh, but when is it realistic to start for these things to start happening again?
Most people believe late October and September we'll see the amphitheaters full, you know, all the outdoor venues full, and by the fall, you know, we think the arenas will be full of people then as well. And, you know, supply and demand, we feel like it's in our favor. We feel like, and, you know, the general consensus is that 2022 will be the biggest concert, you know, music year in the history of the world, because obviously everyone's going to want to tour and be out there. So, you know, we're trying to still be safe. Even our show in Pittsburgh last night, people had masks on,
sure,
you know, but, you know, there's no question this summer it's going to start to open up, and by the fall, we fully anticipate to be wide open. Even California is going to be opening their venues starting in June.
Well, that is fantastic.
You know,
it's John, they're sending me to the top of the hour here, so I'm going to lose you, but give me a holler sometime. I really enjoyed the conversations in the past, and I can't wait for you guys to get going again.
Thank you, Paul.
Talk soon. So good to hear from you. And those were that event in New Orleans, it was unreal. I kid you not. We will take a break. We still have an hour to go, and we hope you'll stick around.
Thank you for listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast. The Paul Feinbaum Show airs weekdays on the SEC Network, beginning at 3 Eastern.